Jeff.
We just stepped on their face with a hobnail boot and broke their nose.
1, 2, 3. Bullshit.
Welcome to the Tide Run Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Bethay, and we're going to skip the intro, and we're going to go ahead and get right to it. The Falcons apparently do not know how the NFL draft works, and before I get to telling you why, it's probably worth at least going over the picks they made. Starting with round one, pick number 8, we took Michael Penix Jr., which we will talk a lot about. In round 2, we traded up to take Ruke Ohorohoro, I hope I said that correctly. At the number 35 pick, we traded up 8 spots and traded our number 79 pick from Jacksonville to get that one. Then we took Braylon Trice with number 74 in the 3rd round, J.D. Bertrand in the 4th round, and then Brandon Dorlus, Jace McClellan, Casey Washington from Illinois, and Zion Logue. And let me back up, because it always bothers me when people don't say what schools these guys are from. So, obviously, Michael Penix Jr. is from Washington. Ruke Ohorohoro is from Clemson. Braylon Trice is from Washington. J.D. Bertrand is from Notre Dame. Brandon Dorlus is from Oregon. Jace McClellan is from Alabama. And Zion Logue is a local, a Georgia Bulldog. Big school feel here. So, the elephant in the room is the Penix pick. And I've had people ask me for the last couple days, when are you going to talk about it? When are you going to talk about it? I had to let it marinate a little bit. Friday was too soon. I was still too raw emotionally. Scott the Stat Assassin and I have been debating this pick back and forth. He defended the pick. I hated it. And before I get to why I dislike the pick, I wanted to share with you just kind of a bigger, broader take I've had on how Atlanta seems to be approaching the draft after 4 drafts now for Terry Fontenot. This is actually, it's crazy to think, but this is actually his 4th draft. His first was the 2021 Kyle Pitts draft. But I kind of sat down and went through the picks and said, what are the trends that we've seen and how they picked? Whether or not you can call this strategy, or maybe it's just this how it's worked out, but the pattern I've seen is that in rounds 1 through 3, the Falcons have decided to go talent over need. So it's been mostly best player available, but their way of evaluating best player has been traits over tape. So they have prioritized potential over production with most of their picks in the first 3 rounds. And they have absolutely no cares or concerns for positional value. So examples of this, Kyle Pitts, who is a player who had great tape, was taken with no regard for positional value as the number four pick in the 2021 draft. Highest tight end has ever been drafted. And as I said at the time, the reason no one drafts tight ends that high is because when you look at a guy like Travis Kelce, who is the best pass-catching tight end in the history of the NFL, has 3 or 4 best pass-catching seasons ever, has never finished any higher than 5th in total yards receiving for a season. And that's the best pass-catching tight end ever. So even if Kyle Pitts turned out to be the best pass-catching tight end ever, he was still not going to be as good as an elite high-end receiver like a Ja'Marr Chase, who we passed on in that draft. And Bijan Robinson is another example of a poor positional value. You take him at number 8. There's a reason people don't take running backs in the top 10. It's because an MVP running back doesn't win you a Super Bowl. Like Christian McCaffrey got really close, but they didn't win it. Todd Gurley got his team really close, and they didn't win it. And those guys had both MVP seasons. Arguably could have both won the MVP. But having an elite running back doesn't get you there. A couple years ago when Derrick Henry had his elite season, finished, I think, 2nd or 3rd in the MVP vote, got his team the AFC Championship game, didn't win it. And we know that elite quarterbacks do win it. So in the case of Pitts and Robinson, you have 2 guys the Falcons took who were elite players with great talent and tape, but had no positional value where we picked them. And then there's other players like D'Angelo Malone, who was taken on just freakish athleticism. He was over a 9 RAS, and he was a solid pick. I mean, we had a needed pass rusher, so we took him, but there are probably more polished players with better production that were on the board at the time that we took him. Another example is Troy Anderson, who we famously took over N'Kobe Dean. Now, neither of them has been very good pros. Anderson's been hurt. Anderson literally tested out as the most athletic inside linebacker ever. He had a 10 RAS, literally the most, or 9.99 RAS. He's literally the most athletic inside linebacker to ever test the combine. Then we took Zach Harrison in 3rd round from Ohio State. Again, solid player. Took him based on traits, linked athleticism. And then Ruke Ohorohoro, who we took from Clemson, who had over a 9 in his relative athleticism, but didn't produce a lot as Clemson, was rated, you know, by most people somewhere between the 6th and 9th best defensive tackle in the class. And we took him as the number 2 or 3 defensive tackle in the class and traded up to get him. And again, there it's like, okay, there's upside there, but the positional value to trade up, take a guy who's not even rated that highly as a defensive tackle was confusing. So there have been some cases where the talent, tape, meet, and value all met. So like Arnold Ebiketie, who we took at the top of the second round, positional need, we took him in the right slot where he was slotted to go, and his talent and tape dictated that was the right place to pick him. And then Drake London. Drake London was a top 10 pick. If we didn't take him at number 8, somebody else was going to take him in the top 12. He was a good player. Everything lined up. And while the Ebiketie pick hasn't hit yet, Drake London looks like a plus NFL starting receiver, which is what you'd expect from a top 10 pick. But then our strategy seems to shift into a more traditional view of the draft in rounds 4 through 7, where we go tape over traits. We find good football players at positions of need who may lack their ideal traits. So examples of this are Drew Dahlman, who is a really small, undersized center, who we ended up drafting, and he became our starter. He's been solid. Last year was Clark Phillips, who was an All-American corner who was 5'9", didn't test well. We took him by the end of the year. He was starting and was surprisingly good and is probably going to start this year opposite A.J. Terrell. DeMarco Hellams, who had limited athleticism coming out of Alabama. We took him because he was just a good football player. He played well in the preseason, and over the course of the regular season, every time we got him in, we played well to the point where we actually replaced Richie Grant with him in our starting secondary next to Jesse Bates. Another example was Tyler Allgeier, who we took in the 5th round 2 years ago. He was a super productive running back that didn't have elite explosiveness, and so he fell in the draft, and it was a strong running back draft, and he goes and runs for 1,000 yards as a rookie. And another one would be Avery Williams, who was an elite returner, who was small, undersized, we took and was a very, very good returner his rookie year. So essentially what I figured out is that in the first rounds 1 through 3, we prioritize talent and don't care about positional value. And as we go deeper in the draft, we start to value tape and production over traits and start to look to actually address specific positions of need. And we tend to just look for good football players. And ironically, all those guys I just mentioned that we took in rounds 4 and 5 have all hit. So we seem to be finding value there. This, of course, leads to the extreme confusion with why we took Michael Penix Jr., who was not the best player available and was not at a position of need, as we just signed Kirk Cousins to a $180 million contract that is locked in for the first 2 or 3 years. So to take Penix, who I like, at that spot, to me makes zero sense. So before I rant and rave to you about why I hate this pick, I want to talk to you about the player who I actually like. And by this point, a lot of you have seen Michael Penix Jr. and you know a lot about him. I went back and watched nearly every throw he had for the past season just to get a better picture of what he was like. And if what I actually saw during the games matched what I was seeing now, I've watched some breakdowns on him. So first of all, Michael Penix is actually kind of like a forgotten good athlete. He had a 9.75 RAS, ran a 4.58 at his pro day, measuring at 6'2", 216. So picture he's roughly the same size as like an RG3 or a Geno Smith, who I think are really good comps for him. RG3, not so much with the running, but with the size. Geno Smith is a great comp. Another one is an old school one, Aaron Brooks from the Saints. They're guys that kind of match. Because Geno Smith is also like a 4.5, 4.6 quarterback who doesn't run a lot, and that's Penix. Penix has never really run, even though he is a plus athlete. I think his career high rushing game was like 67 yards. But he has got a huge arm, one of the best in the draft. Really funky three-quarter mechanics with his left hand. And even though his mechanics are really weird, they're pretty consistent. And his ability to get the ball down the field is what makes him like a high-end prospect. And Penix was rated by a lot of people as like the 6th best quarterback in this class. 5th or 6th, depending on who you ask. And so when we started talking, we were debating about whether or not he would have been there in the second round. Once you realize that Bo Nix went at 12, and we found out there are people that were actually trying to trade back up into the top 10 to get Penix, it's pretty clear that the Falcons would not have gotten him later in the first round and would not have gotten him in the second round. There was no chance. So taking a quarterback in the first round, if that was their plan, had to be done early. And so that's the logic here. The question was, why was it ever your plan to take a quarterback? But again, I digress. Back to Penix. He is accurate and he's very difficult to sack. He was hyper productive. He's actually one of 2 quarterbacks ever to throw for 4,500 yards in back-to-back seasons. The other one was a guy named Patrick Mahomes. So his production really is like extremely high level. His accuracy is good, but not great. And also there's always this distinction between accuracy and ball placement. He is an accurate passer, but his ball placement could be better. So it's probably not as good as you would think looking at his completion percentage, where he's a 65%+ passer with really high yards per attempt because he throws the ball down the field. And like when you watch him, he's got really elite receivers that made a lot of difficult and contested catches on balls that weren't always the best thrown. He doesn't really have that ability to layer throws into the second level the way that really good passers can in the middle of the field. Like somebody like a Caleb Williams, who's an elite thrower, can layer those balls in. And Penix doesn't do that as well. And he pretty much throws the ball at one speed. Now, if you want to attack outside of the hashes, boy, Penix can get it there. And he's good at that. And he's actually pretty good at taking what defenses give him and not playing hero ball. He's actually a good processor. He's not a chunker. He's not just throwing moon balls, hoping his receivers go get him. He's not Joe Milton. So as I watched more and more of his film, one of the things that stood out is how often and how consistently the ball was going to the right guy. Now, he's got a well-documented history of catastrophic injuries. Famously, 4 season-ending injuries and 2 right ACL surgeries. And he didn't run a lot at Washington. He ran more than Indiana. But still wasn't a lot, but he did run more. He's a guy that probably should actually scramble more than he does. He probably doesn't scramble enough. But with the right system and the right development, he could be really good. The swing factors for him are going to be, can he improve his ball placement? Can he get better at handling pressure? And can he develop an ability to change speeds and layer throws? He has some very bad reps against pressure. He was hesitant to run. He didn't always have a plan for how he was going to escape the pocket. He'll sometimes run into sacks, even though he's fast. And those are just things he's going to have to get better at. Because the guy has every physical and mental tool you would look for in a high-level quarterback. So system and development are going to be key for him. He could really thrive in a vertical passing game that takes advantage of his arm strength and his ability to read the entire field. So as a prospect in a vacuum, picks one of the guys that I was hoping we were going to target, just not at number 8. And my biggest issue with the pick is that the Falcons have come out and stated that they recognize that the player they took with the number 8 pick in the draft will not impact winning for at least 2 years. They said as much as 4 or 5 years. So it's not the player, it's not even the strategy of drafting a quarterback and saving him as an asset. It's the asset that we use to execute it. You don't draft and stash the number 8 pick for 3 years. No one's ever done that. Ever. Other teams that drafted and stashed in the top 10, like Kansas City, did it for a single year. The Penix pick is the pick you should have actually made in 2022 when Marcus Mariota was signed with the clear intention of being a short-term bridge starter. A healthy Kirk Cousins realistically takes the Falcons from a 7-win team to a 10-win team, and upgrades at the cornerback position and the pass rush would maybe even make us into a team that could win a playoff game. So that's the problem. You treated the number 8 pick like a long-term future asset. And as much as a draft is for the future, you cannot draft 2-3 years down the road when your team has glaring needs at the present. That's why you're picking number 8. You have holes in your roster. Yes, quarterback was the biggest hole and you filled it. But what about our pass rush? Our team leader in sacks from last year retired. Your starting corner for last year, you let go in free agency. You got holes. You were the 21st defense in the National Football League. You weren't good. You had a ginormous drop-off at the end of the season. So regardless of what people think the Falcons should have been or would have been with a decent quarterback, the objective truth is that they haven't made the playoffs since 2017, and I believe only the Panthers and Jets have longer playoff droughts. Billy, the intern, fact check me on that one. The Falcons are planning for future success when they haven't experienced actual success in 6 seasons. So the logic that they need to take a quarterback because they're never going to pick this high again with Kirk Cousins as their quarterback, that's true. Kirk Cousins guarantees you're going to be a competitive team. But for them to get up and say that they're following the Green Bay model is laughable to me. Green Bay drafted Aaron Rodgers at number 25, and they were already a playoff team that had won a Super Bowl. And they drafted Jordan Love at 30 when they were a 13-win team that was flirting with the Super Bowl. They had win-now rosters. That's not what the Falcons have. So why not actually copy the Green Bay model by taking the best player available this year, and then when you pick in the 20s next year because your team is actually good, draft your quarterback and let him sit 1 to 2 years before transitioning to him as Kirk Cousins' guaranteed money is expiring. That allows you to use a 2024 pick on whomever you had as the best player available. Rome Odunze, Liatu. Rome Odunze, whoever you had listed as the top edge rusher. Fashanu at tackle. Any player that would actually help you win more games in 2024. So this pick is an F- for me. There is no defensible argument for the pick given the current state of the roster and the long-term commitment to Kirk Cousins. And again, Scott and I have vehemently disagreed on this, and I get his side of the argument, but we simply don't agree on this issue. And I think one of the other, as ironic as it is to say, it's probably not going to affect our record this year, truthfully, because as much as Terry Fontenot does not understand how the NFL draft works, He understands how free agency works, and he finds good players on good contracts. So the fact that he's done such a good job in free agency the last 3 years is the reason that we actually still have a chance to be very good this year. But I really think, and I think Scott even agrees with this, our draft strategy is not setting us up for long-term success. Hopefully the Penix pick hits. I really hope it does. It may work out. But I still don't think it was the best strategy for team building. And Fontenot continues to zig when other people are zagging. And he seems to think that he's the smartest guy in the room and that either his board or his draft strategy is superior. But to this point, it has not worked. All right. On a side note, Billy the intern actually did his job and he let me know that we are actually behind the Jets, Panthers, and Broncos for longest playoff drought. So I was off by one team. All right, so I suppose we should get back to the actual draft picks now. So second round pick was Ruke Ohorohoro. I'm probably going to say that wrong all year. But the big thing on him is he's athletic and he can move. He had a 9.92 relative athleticism score. He's 294 pounds. So he protects as a base defensive end in our scheme. And this is where I probably should pause and give y'all a little football background. But Jimmy Lake is a 3-4 defensive coordinator. So we will be shifting more in that direction and away from the multiple fronts that we've used the last few years. But in a 3-4, you have a traditional nose who plays right over the center and is a big body whose job is to get double teamed. And then you have defensive ends who are usually bigger than the defensive ends that you would place in a 4-down alignment, because defensive ends in a 3-4 line up directly over the tackles as opposed to outside the tackles or even outside of the tight ends like they would in a 4-down front. So they're playing directly over tackle, meaning you need bigger bodies. And a lot of times they don't have a ton of pass rush responsibility like you would in a 4-down front. And so for your 3-4 defensive ends, they are guys that are usually bigger, borderline defensive tackle size, and they have some pass rush upside, but they could play blocks against a tackle straight up and hold a gap and play the run and rush the pass when they're called on. So all that is to say, you need bigger defensive ends than what we've had. Like a guy like Calais Campbell is versatile. He can do everything, but he's gone. And so what you saw here with the selections of Ruke and Brandon Dorlus is they're guys that are kind of undersized defensive tackles that had some experience in college lining up at defensive end, and both are pretty good pass rushers for their size. So they were taken to essentially give us bodies at that position, because the edge players that we have, like Arnold Ebiketie and D'Angelo Malone, are really 3-4 outside linebackers. They don't fit as defensive ends in the scheme. The only true defensive end that you really had that fit that mold is probably Zach Harrison. So you needed to add bodies there. So all that to say, this is going to be one of our defensive ends. He's going to be in the rotation. He'll probably play 25% of our snaps. He's active. He plays hard. He has like a really good initial strike with his hands off the line of scrimmage. He pursues the ball. He's got a good motor. The one thing is he just didn't really make a lot of plays in college. Like, he does everything right, but he doesn't really disengage at blocks and make a lot of impact plays. So the biggest issue with this pick, and a lot of you already know what I'm going to say, is we traded our third-round pick and moved up 8 spots to get him. He was, I believe, the second defensive tackle taken when he is rated on most boards as the 6th to 9th defensive tackle. So as soon as he was taken, there was a run on defensive tackles. I believe Jazon Newton, who most people had as the second-best defensive tackle in the draft, went 2 picks later. And then Brandon Fisk went a few picks after that, and Devondre Sweat went right in between the two of them. And it just makes you wonder if the Falcons stayed put, if they would have either gotten him anyway without trading up, or maybe gotten one of these other guys who was actually rated higher than him. So this goes back to what I'm saying, is that in their evaluation process, they clearly put his traits, long arms, twitchy, he ran fast at the combine, he had a top 5 time among defensive tackles, ran under a 4.9, I believe. And they look at all these traits and say, well, even though he wasn't productive in college, we can coach up the traits and we'll get more out of him. So I don't understand why their evaluation on him was so high when you had a guy like Jazon Newton, who's athletic and productive, but it seems like they overvaluated and they had a board that did not match the board that anybody else had. So I don't know. I just don't know. But while we're on the D-line, I need to go ahead and talk about Brandon Dorlus, a defensive tackle for Oregon, who we took in round 5. And I'll come back to Bertrand, our round 4 pick, in a second. But the Ruke pick and the Brandon Dorlus pick really kind of overlap because, again, it's an athletic tweener who's like between defensive tackle, defensive end, Now, he was very disruptive and productive in college. He's the better pass rusher too, with a better toolbox of moves. Particularly, he has a really good swim move. But again, he projects as a base 3-4 end. And as a defensive tackle, I believe he led all defensive tackles in pressures since 2021. And I believe he knocked down 9 passes, which I think also led the country. But he still has some work to do as a run defender. But this was universally one of the picks everybody thought was good. It makes sense in our scheme. He's a productive player, played at a big school, got good athleticism, 8.56 RAS. And this is a pick that's an A. It's good value. It makes sense. And these are the kind of picks that we seem to always make in the fifth round. It'd be great if we could figure out how to do this earlier in the draft, though. So I would expect Dorlus to make the team and be in our rotation unless something unforeseen happens. Now, backing up to round 3, this is probably my favorite pick from the draft for the Falcons, which is Braylon Trice, who is a defensive end out of Washington, and he's going to end up playing outside linebacker for us. He was originally listed in the 270s for most of his playing career, but he weighed into the combine at 245, so he dropped a lot of weight, I assume, to run a good 40, because a lot of guys do this. They'll drop that weight to run that 40, and they'll put it back on by the time they come to their pro day, and then they just won't run again. But he was a 2-time All-American, and he was a pressure machine. So he had 70 total pressures in 2022, which led the FBS, which means, yes, he had more than Will Anderson. And he had 16 sacks the last 2 seasons. So he is a good, productive player. He has, I think, above-average takeoff, but pretty average physical tools. He had an RAS of 7.9, which is solid but not great. And he ran a 4.72, and he's not really flexible, not super bendy, and not super big. He's just good at football. He wins with effort and technique and more effort. He gets a lot of second-chance sacks. He's got a toolbox. He has a plan when he pass rushes. Does a really good job of setting up moves throughout the course of the game. So he'll beat a tackle outside, then they've got the tackle to overset, and he'll beat him with a swim move or a chop inside. So he understands how to play the game. But his average athleticism shows when he tries to turn the edge on like a really deep tackle set. He can't like bend and rip through like really athletic guys can. And he can't really recover if he runs past a play or takes a bad angle. And he also probably misses a few more tackles than he should. But overall, like, this is a really good value pick. This is a guy that might lead our team in sacks with 6 or 7 sacks. And that might be all he ever gets in his career. But he might be one of those guys that gets you 6 or 7 every year. And he's just a solid, dependable player. So, like, this is an A draft pick right here. This is. And I think this selection probably signals the end for D'Angelo Malone on our team. Because not only is Trice a better player, now Malone's behind Lorenzo Carter, Arnold Ebiketie, and presumably Trice, so it's just hard to see a spot for him on the roster. J.D. Bertrand was our pick in the 4th round, and Scott was banging the drum for Peyton Wilson, who's a freak athlete who was really productive in college but was hurt a lot. But Bertrand was also super productive. He's undersized and under-athletic. He is a really good football player, but he has some athletic limitations. So to give you an idea of what this player is like, picture Nate Landman, the Falcons' leading tackler from last year. That's basically what we just got here. He's a really, really good blitzer, and I think this is a good depth pick. He'll be our 3rd or 4th inside backer, and he'll probably play a lot of special teams. And if he has to play, he'll do his job, and he'll do everything right that he's able to do physically. So I think this is like a really good solid depth pick, the kind of pick that you should make in round 4. And I wouldn't be shocked if he gets playing time and plays really well because he's just a good football player. Then in round 6, with back-to-back picks at 186 and 187, we took Jace McClellan and Casey Washington. McClellan, obviously, a running back from Alabama who we're familiar with, a lot of us, and Casey Washington, who's a guy that probably none of us have heard of, who played receiver at Illinois. But McClellan was a pick that was really baffling to me at first, and then I stopped and thought more about it. And I really think the purpose of this pick is as an insurance policy when Tyler Algier hits free agency in 2 years and we can't afford to re-sign him. We now have a capable backup to Bijan Robinson, which is exactly what McClellan's going to be. He's just a solid, well-rounded back. So think like Brian Herrien or Kenny McIntosh for you Georgia fans. He's a guy that does everything well except run really fast. If he has any elite trait, it's probably his vision. But he has good wiggle and power, but he's not really elite in either of those categories. His vision is probably his only elite or borderline elite trait. And at 221, which is actually bigger than he looks, he breaks a lot of tackles, but he's probably not as physical as Tyler Algier, and probably not as elusive as Bijan Robinson. He's also got really good hands in the passing game, although he wasn't asked to run a lot of complex routes at Alabama. And he's going to be just a reliable, solid number three back. He's going to make the team. He's going to play. And when he plays, he's going to do things that well-coached backs do, because all Alabama running backs are well-coached. So getting a break in case of emergency back that's going to be a solid pro in the sixth round is actually really good value. And that's what McClellan is. And he has a chance to be better than that, to be maybe an average starter. But to get that in the sixth round is a really good value. And he's a guy that if one of the starters gets hurt, he could fill in and I think do a solid to good job. So I think this is a good pick ultimately. Continuing the trend of the Falcons addressing logical needs with logical picks at logical slots in the later rounds. Imagine if we did it in the first couple rounds. It'd be amazing. And then we get on to Casey Washington, who is a guy I had no idea about. Picture frame-wise, like a Marcus Rosemead-Jack Saint type of build. He's listed at 6'1", 196. And he's a plus athlete with a 9.32 RAS, 40-inch vertical, 10-foot broad jump, and ran a 4.47. So the guy's a good athlete. Only really productive year was this past year where he caught about 40 balls for 600 yards, something in that range, four touchdowns. Illinois was not great on offense. They weren't great overall, but he was a guy that was not invited to the combine, and there was a lot of surprise about that because apparently he was a pretty decent prospect, but everything about him points to him being a guy that makes the roster and is an NFL receiver. Like, this is not the Frank Darby pick from a few years ago where I told y'all, Frank Darby is a one-trick pony. He runs deep, catches the ball, and he doesn't do it a lot, but like, apparently the Falcons thought that was worth a seventh-round pick. This is not that. This is exactly what the Falcons needed with, which is a young receiver in the room who could potentially develop into a starter because we don't have any youth in our receiving room. Darnell Mooney's not old, and Drake London's not old, but we don't have any young, developing receivers in our room, and this now gives us one. If this guy turns out to be the next Russell Gage, and this is a home run pick. And last but not least, we've wrapped up the draft by taking Zion Logue, who is an interior defense lineman from UGA. He's 6'5", 3'14", and gives you that prototypical space-eating size that you typically want from a nose. And he's not going to be a guy that rushes the passer, but he's a guy that on first and second down can go demand double team, which is what you typically want from your nose, and eat up space. Because the truth is, with David Onyemata and Grady Jarrett, they are really not prototypical noses. They are really more three-tech penetrating defensive tackles, guys that pick a gap, get upfield, and disrupt, and they're both very good at it. So having them play a lot of nose kind of takes away from what they do best, as a lot of times your nose is a guy that two gaps, and again, that's not really what their skill set is. So Logue is a guy that I expect to make this team despite being the last pick of the Falcons draft because he gives you a skill set that I'm not sure anybody else on the roster has. He's a guy that's done it at a high level in college, even if he's not a super high-end prospect. And that's it. And I kind of leave this draft feeling the way I have about a lot of other Falcons drafts. So take the Penix pick and set it to the side. But I feel like up to the last three or four Falcons drafts of the Fontenot era, I've left saying every year, I feel like we drafted players that addressed a lot of the needs in our roster, added depth at the places we needed it, and even built for the future, like with the McClellan pick. And yet, they're not really the players that I thought we would take in the spots that I thought we would take them. And I feel like I say this every year, but there's just a level of inconsistency in the Falcons evaluation process that makes it very hard to predict what they're going to do. They seem to have overly high evaluations on some prospects based on traits, which is actually pretty common in this era of NFL drafting, but they have these high grades on players that no one else has them on. And so I feel like they end up bidding against themselves and they jump up the board to take players like Troy Anderson and Ruke Ohoro, who, and I know they didn't trade up to take Troy Anderson, but they took him over other prospects that a lot of people thought were better. And it just seems like they're outsmarting themselves in trying to cling to their board because they think that their evaluative skills are so much better than everybody else's. Either way, that number 8 draft pick might be the most defining draft pick of the next 10 years of Falcons football. And that's not an overstatement. If this does not work, not only will Terry Fontenot be jobless, he has set our franchise back years. Because anytime you miss on a first-round quarterback, you end up in quarterback purgatory searching for answers. And as we've seen here since Matt Ryan left, the answers can be a lot harder to find than you think. Falcons fans, if you're frustrated, I share your pain. This franchise makes it really hard to root for them, but this is why we're called fanatics. This has been Dave Bethea from the Tide Run Sports Podcast. That's it for today. Thank you for listening.